a shot in the dark. Wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so here we go, kids. Episode, what is it? Episode 249. I looked it up. 249, I looked it up. Man, sneaking up on 250 episodes. That is like, wow. That's just a crazy number for me to think about that I've done 250 of these things. I mean, there's just people mention shows and things that I've talked about. And in my memory, things that I've talked about on the show and things that I've talked about in my, in conversation have melded together because, I mean, a ton of what I talk about on the show, I'd say 85% or 90% of it, has at some point been kind of played out in conversation somewhere. Not all the time, but, I mean, frequently. That is certainly a very, very common thing. And so, it's just interesting that like people are like, hey, you know, you said this and this and this. I'm, oh, did I say that on the show? I didn't remember talking about that on the show. I mean, I know I said that. I've said that 20 times, but I said that on the air. Okay. Yeah. So episode 249, tomorrow will be 250. I have, an interview in the works for tomorrow. I'll let that remain a surprise. If I'd have been thinking about it, you know, maybe I should have, this is a good interview, you know, maybe I should have done something crazy and big for 250. I mean, I don't know why, isn't it weird how we think about certain numbers are like significant milestone numbers, but really what is the difference between 250 and 249 today? I mean, it's like 4 12 minute segments. That's the difference between the two. So, I said all that to say episode 249. So, shout out time to, I'm going to double check this, make sure I'm getting it right. So a listener, this has happened to me a few times where someone will add me on Facebook and I'll look and I'll see, oh, you know, we have a bunch of mutual friends. And so I assume, okay, this is someone who's, you know, seen a comment that, you know, we're mutual friends with so-and-so and, you know, they probably saw me that thread that we just, they had a big thread on his page, you know, and he must like what I said, you know, and, you know, we have 20 mutual friends, right? You know, so these people will add me and I'll say, okay, and I'll be friends with them. I'm pretty open with being friends with people. And then I'll get a note saying, hey, I listened to The Counterposition. So there's two or three of you listeners that have just randomly friended me that I didn't quite realize that's what it was. You know, and it's funny, I've thought about this. And, you know, different people have different tacks on this. I kind of like currently just letting all my professional and Catholic world people and all my listeners and all of my like friends I used to skateboard with in high school and the guys that I used to play music with and the people I used to drink with and stuff, all these, I kind of just let the whole big mess kind of exist on one Facebook page. And there's been, you know, I mean, I think until not too long ago, at least, Patrick Coffin had one Facebook page for the longest time. Just his, he didn't have a page. And then you have like Chris Stefanik has a public persona page, you know, like a public person page, but he, works at like a private page. I mean, he's like constantly on it and quoting and, you know, kind of commenting and stuff, you know? So I'm trying to figure out what to do with that as the show gets bigger and Breadbox Media gets bigger and I'm in that weird place of kind of people know me and I don't know them. Though, you know, that here's the thing. Here's why I think it's not that big a deal. Before I was famous, and I'm not really famous, but before I was ever on the road to any kind of Catholic famous, I was already kind of infamous. It's like I've been in public behind the bar so much, like being the coffee guy, everyone kind of knows me and I may not know you. I know that I've seen you and I've made you something, but I don't, maybe we've had a conversation, but it's like when you meet as many people as you do as when you work in public, you know, and it's funny, I don't know. I've always been the kind of person that the word gets around about. Because so, I think I've kind of been prepared for, you know, people knowing me and I don't know them, you know, it's a, yeah. So anyway, that was a very long introduction for a shout out. And my shout out is to Brian Long. And so Brian is a listener to the Counterposition, and he's in Santa Clarita, California, really close to my old stomping grounds. I think that's still technically Ventura County, I think. So, yeah, if you go, you know, past Thomas Aquinas College on the 126, out past my old shop in Fillmore and the hometown of Perry West, the hometown of, not the hometown, but the current town of, the lovely and talented Blythe Fike and Kirby Fike, you know, the lovely and talented Kirby Fike, and all kinds of people that I love in this world in Fillmore, California. If you keep going away from the ocean, you end up in a little place called Santa Clarita. And Santa Clarita is like an X-Files episode. I mean, in fact, they used to shoot the X-Files there a lot. It's just there are parts of Santa Clarita that are just so suburban sprawl that it's almost surreal. Like, I thought that I was lost in Santa Clarita one day coming back from some event and there was a wreck. So I tried to go through a neighborhood and I thought I was going in circles and it turned out I was just passing identical, like little like strip malls with a, you know, a Quiznos and a Jamba Juice or whatever it was, Conoco in the corner. They were all so similar that I thought I was going in circles, and it was just that someone just figured out a neighborhood and then hit, you know, copy, paste, paste, paste. And just, that was the city planning. It was like, let's just put these five houses over and over again. And every 20 houses, every 30 houses along the side of the road, we'll put this little strip mall with the Quiznos and a Starbucks and a Jamba Juice or whatever. It was just like, oh my gosh. It's just like, it's kind of scary. You know, Santa Clarita and that kind of that suburban, weird kind of plastic environment that is kind of Santa Clarita. That is the world kind of made hyper real and kind of weird and portrayed in Edward Scissorhands. So the Johnny Depp film, the Tim Burton film with Johnny Depp starring as Edward Scissorhands. That was an analogy supposedly of how, Tim Burton felt as being like this weird artist guy going to Cal Arts. There's a college out there called Cal Arts, and he was going to Cal Arts in the middle of like this super suburban environment. And so he felt like some crazy goth guy with, you know, scissors for hands and in the middle of like this like soccer mom reality. And so he did that movie. But I have some people I love in Santa Clarita, and I've had a good time in Santa Clarita. Mostly just going to Six Flags too. What do they call it out there? Oh, Six Flags. They call it Six Flags. There's something else they call it. I'll think of it in a second. Anyway, so, and the only time I'm ever going to Santa Clarita is to get on the 5, and I cannot stand driving the 5. There's something about the 5. If you're a California person, there was a show, the Ellen DeGeneres show, which was what was it? It was before the talk show back in the day. She had this like sitcom, and her character owned this little bookstore called Buy the Book, BUY the Book. And had a fat guy with glasses, and they ran a coffee bar named Coffee Joe, which I picked up as a nickname for a little while working at a Barnes & Noble a million years ago. And then, but at one point in one of the episodes, she was driving and her parents were in the car, and she starts to turn and they start screaming, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" And she like, "Ah," and she gets back on the road and misses her exit. And she's like, "What?" And they're like, "What were you doing?" She's like, I was just getting on the 5. And they just look at her disapprovingly and they're like, "We're 101 people, Ellie." But I tell you what, ever since I tried to drive my friend Andrew Simone's van to San Francisco up the 5 from Ventura County, when you're going to, especially when you get up north of Santa Clarita there on the 5, it's like you have two options. You can be in the right-hand lane chugging at like 30 miles an hour under the speed limit behind a bunch of diesels trying to get up those hills, or get in a left lane and get run over by people going 120 from Los Angeles. I mean, it's just, those are the options. You can go 120 or 35. Either way, if you will get run over, or you'll get stuck behind someone. It's just, and then they get these crazy fogs out there in the Central Valley. Like they have these pileups that are like 50 car pileups and stuff out there. And that's, I ended up in a wreck. I ended up having a wreck happen in front of me, and I got, I hit someone's, wheel that came off. And I'm very bitter with the California Highway Patrol about this. Every time someone brings up the Highway Patrol, I tell them the story. There's like cars flying all over the place with people in them, like going off the road and, you know, other stuff. And I hit this wheel because I was watching the cars with people in them. And they asked me just an innocuous question, like, had it stopped rolling? I said, was it stationary? I think so. And they called it a separate incident and cited me for a moving violation for having a wreck by hitting this debris on the road. I'm like, I was in the middle of a bunch of cars hitting each other. Yeah, but the thing that you hit had gone stationary, and if you were not violating the basic speed law, you would have been able to stop. This is why we don't like government right there. That's just nitpicky and weird. Anyway, that was I talked more about Santa Clarita. I gave Santa Clarita more of a shout out, kind of a negative shout out. I did. But Brian Long and I had a great conversation on Facebook Messenger last night. So nice to catch up and just kind of figure out who people are that are listening. I love it. Reach out to me. Come on. If you're out there and you've never said hi, say hi. I want to know who's listening. All right, so let's go to the break. When we get back, I got more up my sleeve. You're listening to The Counterposition.
I'm a sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. The only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. All right, so yeah, I'm doing my show today, and I'm about to go. I am in a bunker hidden underneath the center of the New Evangelization, nestled somewhere in the Rockies, not unlike NORAD, and one level up in the bunker is, in a few minutes, is the premiere of Forgiven, the new... I don't know what you would call it. Educational, instructional, kind of. They do a really more artful, beautiful job than just that. It's not a documentary, but they're getting more documentary-like. These things that Augustine Studios produces, and then they put them out on form.org. And this one is about confession. So, so they're having a premiere. And we're all going to get a look at it. And there's some good food. I helped them pick out some wine. And we got some popcorn. And, And then tonight, I'm heading over to see the beautiful and talented Zach Candler and his lovely wife and children. And we're going to have dinner and hang out. And we're going to talk about some of the ideas that I'm going to talk about today, actually. We're going to talk about... farming and agriculture and Wendell Berry and Joe Salatin and all kinds of things like that. And we're going to talk about living in an original kind of beautiful way that can, in accordance with nature, so to speak, which is some of the topics I'm going to talk about today. So that's going to go on. I had a rant. I had a rant about traffic, and it wasn't traffic. What was it? It was a rant that I was thinking to myself, oh, I've never ranted about this before. Okay. So I remember thinking it was a traffic light rant. I was thinking I only rant about this kind of stuff usually when I'm talking about traffic. So let me, there's something I just want to get off my chest. I spend a lot of time in coffee houses. I spend a lot of time in coffee houses in a coffee house full of Catholic people. I spend a lot of time in coffee houses full of hipsters and millennials. I spend a lot of time in coffee houses on the road and stuff. Okay, so I'm going to give you the exception to the rule. I'm going to kind of, not the complete exception, but the semi-exception is the airport coffee house. But here's my rant. If you're in a coffee house and you are on the phone in the shop where other people can hear you, stop it. Okay, no, that's not okay. Okay, studies have shown that hearing one side of a conversation in that typical kind of like someone's on a cell phone near you, hearing that one side of the conversation is like 4 to 6 times more interruptive than an actual two-sided conversation going on. You would think, oh, it's half the conversation, it's half as interruptive. But no, you can't hear you when you're over the part that you're overhearing, you can't predict the starting and stopping. And so it catches you off guard. And every time it starts back up or stops, it interrupts everything you're doing and just kind of reboots you. Like you have to like go back to the beginning of the stupid paragraph. It's like, it's really interruptive. And I see people from pagan, atheist, total full on left wing millennial kids to, you know, 50 something Catholic business dudes, all of them talking on the phone in coffee houses. So I'm just going to say, stop it. If people are around you reading, having their own normal conversations, their own writing, trying to study something, you are shutting down everyone around you. If you are on the phone, you are basically making everyone around you's life hard. You know, I just had a guy on the phone in the shop this morning. He was just so, he had headphones on, and he was just like, the whole shop could hear every little word of his side of the conversation. And they were talking about personal stuff and politics and this deal they're working on. And just, I could hear him over the hum. I was behind the counter over the hum of the refrigerator. I'm just like, stop it. You know, and I'm not above, as a barista or someone running a shop, I'm not above looking at someone going, hey, you know, you might want to take that outside, you know, because it's just completely and deeply uncharitable. Now, how does that play into what I want to talk about today? Today I want to talk a little bit about how to live and how we should live and a different way of living maybe. And I don't have a real set agenda for the show, so this is going to get pretty gestalt. I've just got a few points. And I'm a little extra gestalt because I had really bad insomnia last night. As I clicked over to my show notes and realized that the first thing that I had on my notes was insomnia, to warn you guys that I am a little punchy and a little a little more random than normal today. Yeah, I had a hard time getting to sleep, and then I just kept waking up and being up for like 45 minutes to an hour at a time. I woke up a few times last night. I think I finally pieced together about 4.5 hours over the course of the night, but just a rough night's sleep. I just had a ton on my mind, and I just could not shut it off. What was I saying about how to live? How did I get on the insomnia thing? See, there's the problem. I think that we get into these ideas where we're like, we work badly, and then we turn every place into the office because we don't want to be in the office. But then we act in the same way and carry ourselves in the same way and work in the same way outside the office. And I blame it on the cubicle, man. It's just like the it's just you get used to being able to say and do whatever you need to do in your cubicle, and there's these like sound barriers around you, and you get used to tuning everyone out around you. And it's like, I just, you know, ironically, the guy that I kind of like asked to dial it down this morning apologized and thanked me for saying something. He had no idea he was that loud. He didn't think anyone could hear him. And we ended up having a nice conversation about, you know, why he doesn't like working in an office and all this. But then it's like, and if he says, I feel bad, because then I go to a coffee house and I'm kind of turning the coffee house into the office. And I'm like, well, look, man, you can get, you can block emails and calls and stuff into a certain parts of the day. I think we get into this idea that it says that every time the phone rings, we have to pick it up and have a conversation. That's what they make voicemail for. People are busy. You could have easily been on another call. And in a way, you are on the other call. You're working on email. Now, if something's mission critical, you grab it and you walk outside. That's what I do. But it's just interesting. So I remember we had a ice machine that someone was offering to give us, and it was in a suite, a big office suite for a former suite for a famous kind of tech company that was here in Denver. And so we went over there to look at this ice machine to see if we wanted to take it. And I walked in, there's just like this ocean of like super nice high-end cubicles, man. And I get it, man. I am a bad barometer for this stuff because I am never worked in corporate America. I've never worked an extensive kind of office job or anything. And I looked out over this ocean of cubicles and I was just like, that I don't care what you're doing here, that's just satanic. That is just the reduction of the human to like this node of productivity. I mean, there must have been 500 cubicle slots in this space, man. It was just like, and they were, I'm like, that's just not human. That's not a human way to be. But then it's like when you go to, like when my friend Ann and I went to that coffee house up in San Jose, Red Rocks, is owned by a church to reach people or whatever. And you walked in and it's like all these people were just plugged in on this banquette, facing the same direction, headphones in, staring at screens, getting some work done. And they had just were basically acting this, they had escaped the cubicle, but they brought the cubicle with them. And they were just there in their little like tiny invisible cubicle. I'm really worried about the lack of humanity in our work and the way we carry ourselves. I just see people consistently, and it's not, like I said, it's not an ideological thing. I see people talking about their you know, left-wing political activism and their right-wing political activism, or their right-wing religion, or their left-wing kind of art show or whatever. And they're just talking at the top of their lungs or out in the middle of a bunch of people that are all staring at them. And we've lost the ability to be present enough around to the people around us to catch the cues that we're being disruptive because we are so into our own internal environment. And thanks to the new digital media, we can bring our own little environment with us and get plugged into it. And it's, yeah, it's just weird. It's just super duper weird. And so this is kind of what I want to talk about today a little bit. I want to talk about some ideas from the world of ministry, from the world of farming, and a little bit from Wendell Berry. And I want to try to get to something I didn't get to the other day and talk about liberal education and truth for its own sake versus the application of ideas. So, all right. So you're listening to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. We'll be right back.
Then how we crave a hanging in its dark.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
People singing, please don't stay, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. So, I'm going to do this in reverse order. So, I bumped into Greg Funstein, who used to work for Chiaroscuro Foundation, and he went to Thomas Aquinas College with me. He's done a bunch of different things. Works for a financial firm here in Denver now, and we were both at a Thomas Aquinas College alumni reunion here in Denver. And it was interesting. We started talking about everything he's doing, and he has a new project that he's co-founded with Helen Alvarez called, what's it called? I have it. I Believe in Love, which I haven't really looked at. I'll link it. It's kind of a blog set, and I haven't really looked at it very carefully, but it looks like they're kind of doing for dating and relationships and sex and all that, what porn is a new drug did for pornography. It seems like I don't see a lot of I haven't read any of the articles, but on the front page, there's nothing like blatantly religious, but you can tell that this is probably promoting the Catholic worldview in some way. Pretty interesting. I'm going to dig through it and see what I think. Maybe when we get into these actual, stories, maybe there is a bunch of religious talk in them, but I was just talking to him about Flint, Michigan and all these cool things that we're doing there and this great project I've gotten to be part of there. And we just got to talking about how it's interesting where, you know, people who have serious, hardcore, classical, liberal educations, especially in the Catholic world, we tend to be kind of, we're kind of intellectual hipsters, you know, in that, we're hip. We are with the intellectual life and what we do with our life and our vocational life, what hipsters are to other stuff. So, or how hipsters relate to things. And I know I hate that word, but I'm using the word hipster in the, in very much in the kind of the stereotypical way. So first of all, let me define what a hipster is. Hipsters are people who fetishize the authentic and then inevitably can't experience that idealistic vision of the authentic. And so that is back into complete irony and just do whatever they're doing or eat what they're eating or drink what they're drinking in quotation marks. You know, it's like, hey, do you have like this really obscure beer from this? It's only brewed in this one like cave in Belgium, and it's made like with the yeast they get from this one old monk's armpit. And it's just, you know, you can't even, do you have that? Oh, you don't have that? No, I got us have PBR. Hey, look at me. I'm drinking a PBR. I'm drinking like working class beer because they don't have the Belgian armpit beer. I'm just having a PBR. Look at me. Hey, look at me wearing a trucker hat. I have an ironic mustache and I'm drinking a PBR because they didn't have the real beer, which is this obscure beer from this guy's armpit. You set it up as like this fetish. You set up the authentic as this fetish, and then you can't. And it's even more annoying when you get it. Hence, you've seen the funny pictures of like the chick spinning yarn at the, like she's in the waiting room at like the BMW repair place or whatever. It's like, you know, or like the guy riding his camel through Brooklyn or whatever. It's like, I mean, there's a cartoonish kind of version of that. But we really the modern world, especially kind of in that culture, really does that, right? They just kind of fetishize this authentic thing and then back in the irony. And I can't gripe at them because my generation, young Gen X and the slacker movement and all that, we gave them half of that equation. We're the ones that stopped trying and made fun of anyone who did try and just looked bad the right, made looking good, looking bad the right way. So we did that, you know, with Pavement and Superchunk playing in the background. We did that. And wearing thrift store polyester shirts. And So I can't gripe because I did that. And it's funny. They kind of almost are doing that now in the sense of like they've set the – they really want to care so much. But they've said what caring looks like, so, the bar is so high that – you just end up most of the time in this ironic response. So what does that have to do with people with liberal educations and classical educations, especially Catholics? And I think that we at Thomas Aquinas College are very typical of this environment, but I think you'd find this with people from Christendom to a certain extent, maybe some people from Benedictine, you know, just a few people, maybe even outside the Catholic world, like, you know, like the people from the old program at, University of Chicago and the Great Books Movement, St. John's maybe. But the idea is basically like you just kind of get this, you're there, you're awash in these ideas and you're so there for truth for its own sake. And then you basically say, okay, look, here are my options. I can live the life of pure contemplation, which is the end of man and the highest form of life, according to Aristotle. Sorry, I got a frog in my throat here. Or we can, you know, like in the Catholic side of things, like, oh, I'm going to get a religious vocation. You know, we knock out about 11% at our school. It's pretty good. So I'm proud of that. Well done. And we knock out a bunch of PhDs, and we have the highest rate of PhDs in the country by percentage. So the intellectual life and the spiritual life and kind of that, this really idealistic thing is something we strive for. But then when we can't get that, I've noticed that a lot of my friends will just go, oh, well, the heck with it. I'll just get some menial job that just middle management or some kind of job that has nothing to do with anything that we learned or just cause you know, I got to raise a family. I need to make some money. I'm just going to get something that just takes as little of my time, as little as my mental energy. And then you just argue on Facebook all the time and make distinctions. And, but there's a few of us, some of us went into a more of an entrepreneurial life and applied kind of all these ideas and this ability to think in the way that we think two different things. And some of us ended up like doing kind of like innovative ministry stuff. And I would put Greg in that bucket there, you know? And so we bumped into each other and we were talking about this a little bit. And I just loved it. I love when I see someone who has this deeply abstract kind of really idealistic classical education, but they're willing to apply it and actually pull the trigger on it and affect society and do something with it other than just teach or go into politics or go into the religious life. Nothing wrong with any of those things. Well, except for maybe politics, but there's nothing wrong with any of those things. I'm fine with that. It's just, we can't all do that. In fact, this is what I wrote part of my thesis about. We can't all be teachers and generals and aesthetics and religious. I mean, we just can't do that. So what is the next thing to do? And I think that the next highest life would be the life of the entrepreneur. And I mean that in the sense of like the life of the person that uses innovation and idea and the connection of ideas but incarnates them in a way that then they can then be experienced by and lived in by other people. Right. And I don't know, I think that we need to start, all of us that have these really high spiritual and intellectual aspirations and experiences, we need to start building things that we need to apply those principles. It's like, you know, when Plato in the Republics, they're talking about whether or not, trying to figure out where virtue comes to be and dies in a man. And they end up basically trying to build a city. Let's write the soul large. And they build the city and they look at it. And it's like, maybe I was just colored by that idea too much, but it seems like that you can take, you know, Catholic social doctrine, so to speak, this very high kind of solidarity, subsidiarity, the dignity of the human person, the preclusion of use, you know, ends and means and all that stuff. And you can build a shipping program on the way you import coffee or bananas or chocolate can be pedagogical. It can be those principles written into the thing in a way that they can be experienced and even learned through it by taking part in it. And I'm really not good at this. I am much more of a whiteboard. I think about these things. I don't really build them. I just whiteboard them to death. But I don't know. I think that building stuff and making things and trying to reach. I guess what got me thinking about this is that, you know, you can dig back and find my show from Lander, Wyoming, the second time I was up there, and how I just Braveheart preached to these kids for 4 hours, and I came away and I've just heard from several sources by all accounts that 4 hours on that Saturday afternoon really kind of sent a shockwave through that school, and people really responded to what I said. And I think I figured out what it was, is that I was the first person maybe to come along and say, all this stuff that you so beautiful and so amazing for its own sake, you can do something with this. It's not only worth it because you can do something with it, but it is actionable. You can read Aristotle's Politics and then go build something with the insights that you had. You can build a neighborhood. You can build a city. You could build a retirement home or a prison or a school. You could build something in a way. Now, that's why I like my friends like Eric Bootsma and Damiano Forte. These people, Anthony Grumbine, these guys that take these classical ideas and they put them into actual stone and architecture. And you can feel it in the geometry, you know? Anyway, I told you this was going to be gestalt today. So this is what happens when I don't sleep. All right, let's head off to the break. When we get back, I want to talk about a little something else here. You're listening to The Counterposition.
Then all the color glass that painter's palettes mash, all the colors of my soul.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to save. I've bedecked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely, and I'm dull.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. All right, here we go. We're going into the final stretch. And, man, everything I've talked about is just taking longer than I thought it was going to take. This is what happens whenever I don't sleep. I ramble. So I had kind of a strange, last night when I couldn't sleep, I woke up in the middle of the night and Father James Mangan had sent me a link to this Protestant church group movement called Soma. And I watched, I guess, as best I can understand it, they're kind of like the modern emergent version of like the old cell church ecclesiology, where they get together on Sundays and they have a common gathering on Sundays, but they live their life in basic Christian community in these house-based, you know, having their lives knit together in these small groups that are kind of more than just a Bible study or a prayer meeting, because they happen more than just on some night during the week. It's these groups of people who have really knit their lives together in a really beautiful way. And then all these groups come together on a Sunday, but every person in this bigger church is in this smaller basic Christian community. Now, this is an idea that I'd come across in 1994, with Touch Outreach Ministries through bumping into Father John Pringer. And it's actually the night that I headed the next, it was the night, the interaction that I had that night was what led me back into the Roman Catholic Church, meeting Father John Pringer in a coffee house at Lakota Coffee in Columbia, Missouri, after watching Rocket Kirchner. I wonder whatever happened to Rocket Kirchner. I should look up Rocket and see what's going on with him. Talk about an interesting cat. And he played If I Had a Rocket Launcher by Bruce Coburn. And Bruce Coburn conversation overheard turned into conversation, which turned into me bumping into a guy that was a priest that I didn't know was a priest, and ended up with me at a conference the next day for a cell church ecclesiology. And back into the Catholic Church, I think, by the end of the weekend when it was all said and done. So this is kind of the modern outgrowth of that cell church analogy, and it's called Soma. So I'll put the link there. I would watch a few of their videos. I think it's very applicable to a Catholic context, and I think this is going to be some of what we are working on as a model up in Flint, Michigan, is putting together some kind of structure like this, but infusing it with Catholic principles and a Catholic understanding of reality. So I'll end up talking more about this stuff at some point. And, but then, so I was up in the middle of the night and I looked at this link and I watched a couple of these videos. And then I went over to Facebook and I saw I'm friends with, Facebook friends only with, Mike Matern, the guy that was running for president on the American Solidarity Party. And Facebook decided to tell me that Mike had commented on something in the American Solidarity Party page. So I guess it was a friend commented on something in a group that I'm part of. So I went over and looked, and it was a little fight broke out over Pope Francis and climate change and him adding stewardship of the earth as one of the corporal acts of mercy. And people were saying, you can't add a corporal act of mercy. And it's like, actually, yeah, there's a one or two of them were added through popular piety based on civilization in the medieval period. It's like this isn't dogma. This is very old tradition, but old tradition can react to and be, I mean, look at John Paul II added 5 mysteries of the rosary. Talk about gutsy. That was even more gutsy. Anyway, so they were griping back and forth at each other about Pope Francis, and Pope Francis someone hasn't let Pope Francis in on the fact that he needs to speak in a way to where he has to remember that America, the wealthy suburban America, is listening, and we use our existence as a hermeneutic for everything he says. So, and he just doesn't seem to care. And so he gets misunderstood a lot, especially about environmental things. And so someone posted this little mini documentary called Polyfaces about Polyface Farms and Joel Salatin. Now, I've been a fan of Joel Salatin for forever. I adore Joel Salatin. He's a guy that took this just brutally, just no other word than raped piece of farmland. It was just one of the most worn out, the agricultural version of strip mining, basically just thin soil and just treated like hell. And he has taken this and made it arguably one of the most productive farms with the richest soil in the world. And he did it through grass-fed beef rotation and chicken and turkey and sheep and goat rotation and the healing of the soil through the rotation of these different species through and all of their manure and all the bugs and all the everything that happens. And letting the stuff grow in, letting the trees grow, letting the other plants grow, and growing food in the context of all this very full ecosystem, kind of a permaculture kind of a thing. And so I watched this little Vimeo video on Polyface Farms and Joel Salatin and all the people there, they were just talking about what it means, and it's about the people and about the community. And I just saw that it had so much in common with what this religious group was talking about in these Soma churches. And so maybe it's just a weird situation where I see two things at the same time, and I see that they're about the same thing. And I think what it is that it's about. So what is all this about today? Why do you not talk in a coffee house and don't talk on a phone in a coffee house? Why are cubicles not a good way to have people working? Why is is living in basic Christian community between the weekends important? Why is grass-fed beef farming in a way that is respecting nature? What, you know, and what is it? And this is all kind of like an application of these ideas, which is kind of what I was talking about with the whole liberal education thing, is that we see these big ideas like nature acts for an end, right? And these different ideas of community and these different ideas of how nature works and how to act in accordance with nature and art imitates nature and all these ideas. And I'm telling you what, if you go look at Aristotle and you look at his notion of nature, you look at how nature acts for an end, you look at all these concepts, and then you go look at that farm where Joel Salatin is, you'll see those ideas writ large, like Plato did in the Republic. You'll see human community working with nature in accordance with nature to provide what nature will provide if you work along with it instead of fighting it and trying to kind of make it do something it's not designed to do. Just beautiful stuff. Just really good stuff. So I'm going to put both of those links up. And I'd love to see you guys comment on this stuff. Throw some feedback my way. Maybe I'll put them both up on the Facebook page and let me see if we can get some quotes and some conversation going, some comments underneath it. I guess I'm under the influence of Wendell Berry right now. I picked back up my copy of Art of the Commonplace, and he just started talking about this, and I didn't leave nearly enough time to talk about this, but it's really, really interesting what we did to the Indians by introducing all this technology and a way of using it that wasn't really, they didn't get a chance to kind of develop into, so to speak, and how it disrupted their society. And it's similar, I think, to what happened in our last century. So I want to explore that farther, maybe in Friday's show a little bit, because I have an interview for tomorrow. But I want to look at disruption of technology and in society a little bit. But one thing that he was talking about is how, and this is what got me thinking about Polyface Farms a little bit, was that, you know, there's different ways to grow. One thing I love about my alma mater, Thomas Aquinas College, is that they have about 400 students, and that's what they want. They designed the entire thing to work with 400 students. It's a village made of 400 students and the people who serve them. That's it. If it gets too big, if they keep getting more and more applications every year, they'll build a second campus. It's designed to function, and once all the buildings get built and everything is done, then they will find new ways to make it better and stronger and to grow in other ways. Anchor Steam the beer company is the same way. They put out X amount of beer and that's it. Look at Una Pizza Napolitana. He's open from Thursday through Sunday from 5 p.m. until the fresh dough runs out. He makes the same amount of pies every night, has been for years. There's ways to grow without constant increase of production. That is not the only way to grow. And I think something like Polyface and Joel Salatin has a lot to, the way he farms has us a lot, has a way, a lot to teach us about how to build a business and maybe even how to build a church. So, I'm going to throw these, two links out there for you and let you have a look at them and see if you see some commonalities like I do. And, hey, thanks for playing along. This is a pretty random just all show today, but I've learned to, when I have insomnia, I'm not going to try to be exact. I roll with it and do what I'm good at whenever I'm in this mood and I feel this way, and that's rambling and musing. All right, so let's pull the plug and pop the cork in another episode of The Counterposition. See you next time.
I take your place, marble stone. I take your place, marble stone.